Okay, so thank you very much for joining us today, and a very warm welcome to the audience in the room, as well as our participants who are joining us online. And I have to say thank you very much to our speakers and discussant for joining us. My name is Lydia Omukwayu. I'm a legal analyst at Climate Change Mitigation Initiative that we've just launched today. I'm also a doctoral researcher at the Institute of Public Law and Political Science, University of Graz in Austria. I know we have all seen the program that Francesco was supposed to be there, but unfortunately he couldn't make it today, and I will be chairing this session. And together with me are three speakers here, and we have one who will be joining us online, as well as one discussant. We'll begin with interventions from the speakers, about 8 minutes each, and then the discussant will start off the discussion, and then we'll open the session to the participants, both here and online. So I do encourage our online participants to please use the Q&A function, and then the questions will be picked up, and they'll be sent over to our speakers. And then this session, I hope we all know that we're in the session that will focus on international and regional litigation. And although climate litigation has not become widespread in international fora like it has happened in most domestic litigation, we are seeing quite a rise in international litigation in international bodies. And there are quite a number of pending cases in regional courts, for instance, the European Court of Human Rights. We have one in the East Africa Court of Justice. We're also seeing some cases in treaty bodies, and as well as international arbitration bodies. But then climate litigation is not always a smooth journey. We have seen that from domestic litigation as well as international litigation. And the recent decision of the UN Committee on Human Rights of the Child declaring the case inadmissible points out to some challenges that climate cases are facing and are likely to continue facing in some of these bodies. But at the same time, international bodies are actually making some important pronouncements in advancing our efforts towards addressing climate change. For instance, expansive interpretation of rights, considering recognition of the obligation of extraterritorial obligation of states as relating to climate change, and even just the recognition of the right to healthy and clean environment. So the question is, to what extent are these regional and international bodies well suited to deal with the issue of climate change? And that is what we'll be discussing in this session today. And the session will focus, will explore the extent to which international courts, commissions, committees, and arbitration courts are well suited to deal with the issue of climate change. We will reflect on the potential impact of climate change litigation in these international and regional arenas on the overall effort to address climate change. And it is now my pleasure to welcome our panelists today. And our first speaker is Nikki Reich. Nikki is the director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Center for at the Center of International Environmental Law, which is a nonprofit organization that uses the power of law to protect the environment and promote human rights. Nikki, having been in this climate change and human rights space, could you provide us with an overview of the recent international law developments on the intersection of human rights and climate change? And probably you could provide us with some insights on the implications of the recent Human Rights Council resolution recognizing the right to clean and healthy environment. The floor is yours. Thank you.
I suppose I will take my mask off, which is always an act of faith in a room of lots of people in this time. But good afternoon, everyone, and thank you to the organizers. I hope I'm visible and audible. For those who are following online, I will just say that you are missing a huge climate march that is going by here. And it would be remiss to begin any sort of remarks without noting that, especially because I think as we sit here and discuss the role of international climate litigation, international human rights law, and on addressing the issue of climate change, I think it's really important to understand that that is but one tool in a much broader toolkit, and that public pressure and popular pressure to change policy is absolutely instrumental to any and all advocacy. I think certainly litigation is no exception to that. that winning in the courtroom is only one dimension of a victory. And even when you lose in the courtroom, you can win through public opinion. And I think many in the room who are actively fighting cases or are involved in pending litigation or who have won cases recently, such as in the Netherlands, know just how crucial it was and has been and remains to have really strong public pressure on decision makers. So with that, I bring you virtually a little bit into the reality that is Glasgow. It has stopped raining and it is loudly protesting outside. So it's really a pleasure to be here. And I think in some ways, Lydia gave an introduction a bit to what I will just briefly sketch out and really look forward more than anything to the discussion, because there are so many people in the room and joining us online who are actively engaged in really analyzing and identifying what to make of developments on the international and regional level and their relevance for ongoing pushes to address the urgent crisis that is climate change. So I think, against the backdrop of COP, which is happening here, not just the outside protests, but the negotiations as well, we can really see that with the limits of politics and diplomacy, the importance of litigation and the pressure that can be brought to bear through human rights fora and through domestic courts and jurisdictions that can bring human rights law to bear is critical for ratcheting up the pressure, for increasing ambition, and for giving definition and color to the policies that are being sketched out in domestic and international level. So I think it's quite distracting. This is a good challenge. I wish we could turn the camera and show you. There's a great there are great banners and prize. I shall refocus. I think, as it was said in the earlier session, that, I believe it was Tessa Kahn who really emphasized that climate change is in fact a systemic and fundamental challenge to human rights. And that's really beyond contest now. And the role of international human rights bodies, from human rights treaty bodies to courts to other experts such as the special rapporteurs, has been essential in really making that point crystal clear, that the climate crisis impacts the full range of human rights and is a fundamental issue. And in the same regard, it is a fundamental challenge and test to human rights institutions to see whether they can and are capable of rising to the occasion and finding ways to intervene. And indeed, we've seen that they are and are being increasingly called to do so. So we've seen in recent years, and this last year is no exception, an increase in the number of human rights treaty body observations, just speaking first about their advisory capacity, how many times the human rights treaty bodies that monitor state implementation of their obligations under human rights treaties are being called to address not only the impacts of climate change, but the role of states in addressing climate change and the adequacy of the policy actions and measures they're taking, as well as the human rights impacts of some measures being taken in response to climate change. So we're seeing an increasing number of concluding observations and recommendations taking on these issues. And one of the frontiers where we've seen a big uptick in the attention has been in addressing squarely what the parties in the negotiations won't name, and that is fossil fuels, using the F word to talk directly about the primary drivers and the responsibility of states to address their ongoing engagement and investment and in promotion of fossil fuels and other drivers of climate change, such as deforestation. And so we're seeing an uptick in those recommendations and statements that are crucial normative interpretations. And I think those are critical in creating what is a feedback loop between the international and national level, and have given many advocates who are working on national policy and in national litigation tools to hold up and to press their governments and to encourage and give cover for judicial members of the judiciary domestically to make similar findings based on either constitutional provisions or human rights provisions in their own national law or where they've incorporated those international obligations. So another area where we've seen increasing attention from human rights bodies in their advisory capacity and interpretive capacity has been addressing financial actors, and all of this under the rubric of state obligations to regulate private actors, and that they are beginning to pose tough questions to states and tighten the screws and scrutiny at the international level of the relationship between the lack of regulation on the part of states and contributions to climate change. As has been mentioned already, we're also seeing an increasing number of cases that are bringing the issue of climate policy and climate action before international adjudicatory bodies, quasi-judicial and judicial. As was already mentioned, we know that there are three pending cases before the European Court of Human Rights, which involved the first one, of course, involves a case against 33 countries and others also against Switzerland and against Norway. All three of them really tee up very different and critical issues and some very similar issues, but they provide the European Court with ample opportunity to engage and to really tackle where human rights law can help define the contours and content of what is necessary climate action. And that's really the takeaway that I wanted to start with and got distracted by the march, but I'm really leave you with is that we're really seeing a trend in an emergence of a context in which human rights law is increasingly becoming the enforcement regime for environmental law. And I think that's because human rights law, there's a number of reasons, but really we're seeing that human rights law, based on very well-established and long evolved and continually evolving principles, including the fundamental principle, as referenced earlier by Tessa, that states have a duty to take immediate action within their power to address foreseeable harm to human rights. And that means to take action to prevent and mitigate harm. And they have to take actions that are appropriate and within their power. And so it really does shift the burden onto states to justify why they are not taking actions that are available to them that are necessary. So it becomes more and more apparent as we see these cases playing out, and even in instances where we see dismissal on procedural grounds, that the role of human rights law in these human rights bodies is actually giving color and flesh to the obligations that are often too broad and high level, but that human rights law is not just about defining a generalized duty to take some action, but actually is increasingly giving content to what measures are not adequate. And that's really where the frontier and where we're pushing this in terms of the arguments that are before the European Court, in terms of the arguments that are being brought before the human rights treaty bodies, is really to push on what constitutes adequate action and what types of measures are not meeting up to states' duties. And we see that playing out at the domestic level. So it goes without saying that in this past year, as was earlier mentioned, in citing the uptick in domestic cases, there are increasing numbers of cases addressing human rights and constitutional law at the domestic level. And there we've seen some really important and bold steps, such as in the German case, such as in some references earlier in agenda, as well as in aspects of the Irish case, where judges are actually addressing the inadequacy or the insufficiency of either articulating long-term targets or relying on technologies that are either unproven or unavailable in the short term. And those are hugely important observations, that that is inconsistent with the principle of prevention and the duty of and the precautionary principle, which are firmly established in international law and that give a benchmark and a rubric against which to measure the adequacy of action. So it's not enough now just to say, yes, human rights law recognizes climate change impacts human rights. Beyond contest, certainly the contours of those impacts are playing out now, they're not just in the future, but also that human rights law requires urgent, near-term, immediate action, and that action has to be what is necessary and within the control and power of the state to mitigate foreseeable harm. And that's where we're seeing the evolution of science intersect with human rights law, is really around understanding what foreseeability is, because there has been a sea change, I think, really, in what is uncontestable consensus around not just the impacts of climate change. The IPCC's Working Group 1 report this year made imminently clear, if it wasn't already, what a crisis is right now and what that's unfolding. But the IEA's report earlier this year, along with the Production Gap report, has also firmly established the contribution of fossil fuels to the climate crisis, and that there is a deep understanding of the timeline on which change has to happen and the factors that are contributing to and causing the crisis. So that when, as that knowledge base becomes both politically and scientifically adopted, it provides a tool and a ground from which human rights experts and adjudicators can interpret and apply the clear human rights principles regarding the duty to take preventive measures in the face of foreseeable harm, and make and give that teeth and give that content, and not just treat climate policy as a checkbox. Can I have a time check? Because I'm not paying any attention. Is anyone? The 8 minutes goes by quickly. I'm sure it's already 8, maybe 10, but I will indulge for just two more minutes. That's a good number to give me, 2M, to wrap up. But I did want to touch on, you know, a couple other things. I think that, as we'll talk about later in the discussion, that the cases that have come before the human rights treaty bodies and their individual complaint mechanisms have really shown both an evolution in human rights law, the capacity of human rights law to address environmental harm, and also some of the challenges that we face as advocates in formulating our demands and in tracing the line between the roles, appropriate roles of domestic and international bodies, and helping to urge international human rights bodies to step in to their critical role in filling the interstices and pushing the boundaries of law, because that is in fact what those quasi-judicial mechanisms are designed to do, to help provide normative interpretations that help to push those boundaries. And so I think, you know, if we look at the Human Rights Committee, before turning to the CRC, the Committee on the Rights of the Child, the Human Rights Committee has been slowly and carefully establishing a jurisprudence that recognizes the critical obligations that states have to address threats of environmental harm, and they're grounding that in interpretations of the right to life. And they've done that from their general comment 36 on the right to life, for those who are watching, and also subsequently in individual cases, they've decided the Portillo case, on a Portillo Cáceres case, where they firmly established that the failure to prevent pollution is a violation. And most recently, in a case addressing, again, I guess in the Campo Agua case, addressing how the failure to take action to prevent pollution and degradation of land is a violation of rights. And I think while those cases weren't squarely about climate change, they firmly established the logic and the rubric that we will be able to leverage both internationally and domestically to and send signals to courts like the European Court that is facing these issues right now about how to interpret those things. And I think the key question I'd love to discuss with the rest of the panelists, and I know we'll get into this more, coming out of the recent CRC decision, is really a critical one about what is the meaning of effective remedy, and how do we define what effective remedy is in a way that actually provides the contours for international bodies to identify what is and is not deliverable through domestic mechanisms, and where might they effectively step in. And I think there's some important grounds for us to discuss here about what that means, how we as advocates treat that question, and how we encourage the human rights institutions to step up to the urgency of the moment and the critical role they play in addressing crises that are really truly multilateral, if ever there was one. So thanks. I managed to take up enough time that the protest is, you know, a little quieter for the subsequent speakers.
So thank you, Nikki, for giving us not only the recent developments, but the role that the law, the role that human rights is playing in addressing climate change and how the courts are dealing with them. One thing I forgot to mention in the beginning is that one of our panelists will unfortunately not be joining us today. He had to join another meeting urgently, and unfortunately Solomon will not be joining us today. So that gives me the pleasure of introducing our second speaker, Ingrid Gabe, who is a litigator and a campaign lawyer with Housebelt, where she conducts strategic public private litigation and advice both domestically and internationally, and heads the human rights and environment team. I think some of us, if not most of us, are aware that Ingrid is involved in several key climate related cases. And what she will do is that she will provide us with some insights based on her involvement in these cases, including the legal complaint that was recently decided by the UN Committee on the Committee on the Rights of the Child, which was filed on behalf of 16 young people from around the world. So Ingrid, welcome, you have the floor.
Thank you, Lydia. I would much rather be out there, actually. Would you? Feels a bit weird being in here when we could be out there. I can remove this. I'm in a lawyerly kind of way. I'm going back to the question, which is, are international tribunals well suited to climate change litigation? I think that was the question. And Nikki's excellent presentation was a great segue into looking at this question perhaps more closely. And I'm sure many of you will have views about that, as well as the idea of effective remedy. I wanted to put a spotlight on what's going on. And is that questioning compared to what? Compared to domestic litigation? Is there an implicit kind of question about whether perhaps it is not fit for purpose for climate litigation? And we can discuss different angles. But what I wanted to also introduce is the idea that there are 40 other international tribunals, courts, committees out there, each with their own working procedures and methodologies and their own committees of working. And it's important not to forget about the 40 other international tribunals, courts and committees. Some who will be addressed today, I think Wendy might touch on arbitration, investments dispute settlement and so on, which is coming increasingly in the picture. But I think it's important as creative lawyering in the climate change space, and particularly if you happen to be padding around in the international fora, to make sure that we don't leave anything out in our in looking at this. And I understand in October 2021, there are another 19 cases filed before regional and international bodies. So there's quite a lot of spotlighting, a lot of work going on there, when previously it was all very domestic. And some of those international institutions and committees are ad hoc, and some of them are more permanent, but obviously all of them are worth excavating. I wanted to touch, unfortunately Solomon isn't here, and I'm sorry that he's not here because he would have spoken about the ICJ and the opinion. And I haven't been given a formal proxy, but I might just say a few words about the ICJ's role in terms of perhaps clarification and guidance in this area. So many of you will be familiar with Lavanya Rajamani's input on this, and wonderfully she's part of that legal team that's bringing the ICJ opinion. I've had a lot of contact with Lavanya over the years. And so, as we know, the ICJ is a body where it's fairly conservative. There's a lot of squeamishness about the composition of the body at the moment, being quite conservative. There's some long discussions about the framing of the questions to the ICJ and not giving them any wiggle room in terms of the way that they can respond. So there is some concern about the questioning. I have no concerns about the legal team that's on that, and I'm sure they'll come up with the very right questions. But in interpreting climate change and particularly environmental international law, in terms of customary international law, there are some very good things that they could be doing in looking at what is the highest ambition, what is a fair share, looking at some of those questions, which I think will be coming up to look at. It'll be interesting. I haven't seen the question that's being raised by Pacific Island. Someone else in the room might know. But I think we're quite excited about the idea of that question being submitted soon. The other tribunal I want to talk about is the International Law of the Sea, which, you know, doesn't come up a lot and ought to be up a lot. 10 years ago, we were very involved in a big all singing, all dancing advice to Pacific Islands in relation to ITLOS. And it has a very, what would be conceived, it's generally known to be quite progressive. It's very established. It has an article which protects seas and marine reserves. It's, here, a state bringing another state to ITLOS in relation to pollution of marine environments is possibly something that ought to be, if it's not being done at the moment, it's something that should be on the radar. So I think the ITLOS is something that we need to be thinking a lot more about. In terms of those sorts of committees and international bodies, I think we've got some fertile ground in which to get some clarification on some of the issues that Nikki has raised. Now, turning to the UNCRC, everyone's very excited by the points, the positive aspects of that decision. Nikki's mentioned extraterritoriality, Tessa mentioned territoriality. I've had two approaches over this week. of people saying it's now being integrated into cases that they are bringing. So it has that effect, a replicable effect already starting to happen. So is there a benefit in bringing cases before these human rights treaty bodies? So the brief, which came from the Thunberg family, really was to create impact, to work together with a group of people from around the world, other youth affected by climate change. And so that was the idea, is to test out the only convention that's available to children in the human rights treaty body system. And of course, a convention which contains specific environmental protections, because it's drafted later in the 1980s, that has the optional call three, the individual complaint mechanism. And the timing, as Nikki pointed out, of the statements, the general comments, the HRC commentary, the joint statement by the five different committees on the heightened risk to child, climate change. All of these were extremely timely back in 2019 when the world was another normal. The brief happened in basically in March 2019, proposal in April of 2019, and then the filing in September of 2019. And of course, it's taken till October this year for that decision. But why? Partly because of COVID, but partly because the committee actually did some innovating procedural things along the way. The appeal hearing, which was held in May this year, I was in quarantine in Darwin at the time, was a 3-hour hearing where the children could present in a closed court their experience directly to committee members, never done before. So that had a huge impact on the committee. The president of the committee was extremely happy to have the petitioners present orally. Of course, the issuance of the open letter by the committee to the petitioners with the decision to explain the decision in simpler terms so that that could be communicated to many of their constituents. Many of the petitioners are climate activists in their own country. They have huge networks themselves. They've actually put together their own legal hub. They have submitted open letters to Norway, to Sweden on oil drilling. They come together, they're extremely empowered through this process. And you only have to ask any one of them, who are often on different podiums around the world now, giving their own view and helping decision makers. They are often present at those. The other issue is that the communication itself, we are told by the CRC, will now create a springboard for a new general comment on children's rights and climate, which I think will be very important. So not only did we have on the positive side, the win on extraterritoriality, the win on jurisdiction to determine the cases because the state's responsible for regulating emissions from their territory that harm other children's rights. We also met the standard on causation. But it has to be borne in mind that this was an admissibility decision, not on the merits. So we didn't get through to the merits, and we don't know what that might have looked like. But at least we have a dawn of a new hope there. In terms of the obstacle, one might say, which of course was an obstacle, I drafted the proposal back in April, highlighting to the Thunbergs the issue of domestic remedies. We talked it through. They were very keen to still pursue the matter. And so the discussion took place with all petitioners about the risks to this litigation. And that the fact is that it may not do what we hoped it would do. Thank you. Thank you. So it's very timely. Just as we get to the obstacle as well. So the exhaustion of domestic remedies. Now, some commentators will say, and there's been a lot of commentary around the decision, that due to the low ratification of the optional protocol itself, being only 46 countries, which is already, I think, something that ought to be lobbied hard on. I think there needs to be a lot of work done to get other countries to sign up to the ratification procedure. Child's Right Connect is working very hard to do that, who is the NGO who drafted the optional protocol 3, who I worked with closely during this proposal. So the exhaustion issue, some will say it would have been gutted if they had allowed it, that is the ratification and the procedure itself. Others say it could have been a lot more nuanced, and I tend to agree in that, of course, we had petitioners representing states from around the world. We know that Germany, Netherlands, France, the judges are all learning from each other. They're in a close network. They're putting out really good decisions. The UN Human Rights Council has said the Pacific Islands has 10 to 15 years before those islands are going to be flooded, which is about the same time as lots of domestic litigation and its decisions and its appeals. And we are talking about petitioners who would have had to basically file 80 different proceedings in different countries over time to have got to work towards these the remedies that they were seeking. So it could have, we say, in terms of the committee, I agree with the commentators who say we could have had a very nuanced decision which distinguished the petitioners in certain jurisdictions where they, yes, domestic remedies were probably more available from those who it's very unavailable at the moment. And therefore, I think the committee failed on that opportunity. And this is a time, of course, when the committee could have made a difference to children, particularly in those countries. And that opportunity has been lost in the sense of not creating a nuanced position for those petitions from those countries where jurisdictions are less robust, less access to justice, or there just isn't the basis to bring these actions, domestic actions. And that gets overshot a lot. The Pacific Island legal systems, the unenforceable judgments in other countries. And when we talk about enforceability, which is supposed to be the other bit thing that I'm talking about, I think there's a general problem in domestic litigation as there is in international. Look at the numbers of domestic cases that can't be enforced, or the bills that are going through Parliament where the enforceability provisions are washed down. We're looking at environmental and ecology bill going through the UK Parliament at the moment. It's supposed to have protections for water and rivers. That was absolutely vital and critical to it being washed out. So talk about enforceability. Let's talk about it across all these fora and not just the international jurisdiction, where international human rights law is binding on all countries and all nations. It's absolutely foundational. So I think we need to get perspective on that. And with that, my closing, that's it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ingrid, for giving us quite some extensive insights on this case, as well as just, I think it's also important for us to just understand the strategies behind these cases, so that even if an outcome, even if we get an outcome that is not successful in terms of not having a positive outcome from court, but then they also have some other impacts, and this could just be based on certain strategies that parties come with in these cases. So just a reminder to our online participants that you can keep on using the Q&A option to send in your questions, and they'll be brought to the attention of the speakers. And our third speaker will be joining us from Zoom. I hope he's there. So our third speaker will be joining us from Zoom. That is Cesar Rodriguez. Yeah, there. I will just get you back. Thank you. So our third speaker is Cesar Rodriguez Caravito, who is a professor of clinical law and chair
and Faculty Director of the Center of Human Rights and Global Justice at New York University School of Law. As a scholar and a practitioner, his focus areas are global governance, climate change, socioeconomic rights, business and human rights, as well as the human rights movement. Cesar will talk to us about the relevance of international bodies for climate change litigation against private parties. So we are moving away from state to private parties, considering the potential exchange between domestic, regional, and international level. So Cesar, you have the floor.
Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you all in the metaverse that Facebook would want us to all be sooner than later, but I would much rather be in the physical world of that room. And I would love if it would be possible to turn the camera to the audience, but also as Nick mentioned, the protest going on outside the room and the very audible noises being made by that young crowd also makes me very envious about those of you in the room. Thank you. That's very nice, Amelia. Now I can see the audience. I thought that I would take a step back as Lydia mentioned, the work that I do with colleagues in the Climate Litigation Accelerator at NYU School of Law combines litigation, advocacy, and academic research, and also importantly works with organizations from around the world, convening a community of practice through which we try to support promising ideas for litigation and advocacy emerging literally around the world. So really what I'm going to present is a couple of ideas that have emerged from conversations and a forthcoming book that we're publishing with some of the researchers and activists who have been part of this conversation for a couple of years now. And since I don't have the advantage of being with you all and time is limited, I thought I would share two slides with two images. You know, the saying goes that 1,000, an image is worth 1,000 words. So I guess that if I had to write this as a blog, it would be a 2,000 word blog. So two images equals what I have to say today. And I'll start and I'll use three keywords. One is strategy. The second one is scale. And the third one is speed. And I'll start with the strategy, bringing some of the lessons from activism, litigation, and studies on human rights-based advocacy litigation in other fields. I came to environmental issues and climate issues through the gate of indigenous rights advocacy and litigation and socioeconomic rights advocacy and litigation. And one thing that we've been trying to do is encourage colleagues in climate litigation to learn from those previous waves of excellent work being done in the Global South and also in the Global North on socioeconomic rights litigation, indigenous rights litigation, and other forms of human rights work. And the first image that I want to share with you, and I hope that you can all see it here, is from work that has been done on socioeconomic rights. This is a 2x2 that I included in a previous work on socioeconomic rights litigation that I think helps us understand the strategies that are being deployed in the younger wave of climate litigation, both against states and against private actors. So as Nikki said, the connection with social movements has been key in other waves of human rights advocacy. And I actually think that this is a distinct characteristic of climate litigation in that it is much more driven by social movements like those protesting on the streets in Glasgow than previous waves of human rights work. And that explains that many of the key lawsuits have been filed either in collaboration with social movements or directly by social movement organizations, right? From Greenpeace to Friends of the Earth, to Fridays for Future. And that's not by any means something that you would have seen 20, 30 years ago as socioeconomic rights litigation was on the rise. And what I think that allows us is to have a broader view of strategy. And the way in which I would encourage everyone to think in these broader terms is by understanding the goal of the 100 plus human rights based climate cases as trying to achieve four types of goals, which is of course the cells here that result from the combination of the horizontal and the vertical axis. This is very simple, so I'll go through it very quickly. Just want to get the basic idea here. One can think of lawsuits trying to attain direct and indirect effects. So direct effects is of course what most of us litigants and lawyers focus on, whether or not, for example, Shell, to use a recent example against a corporate actor, will cut emissions in line with the ruling of the Hague District Court, and in turn, in line with what science and the Paris Agreement would want humanity to move towards. So that's a direct effect. But there are also equally important indirect effects that may arise from that particular case. For example, it's already, and I've done some research on this with colleagues at CLX, it's already affecting conversations in corporate boards in other fossil fuel companies. So the litigants of Milieu Défense and other organizations may or may have not had that in mind, but that indirect outcome of the case, to my mind, is equally important because, as we know, the climate crisis won't be solved on a case-by-case basis. So indirect downstream and transnational lateral effects are equally important when it comes to evaluating the impact of climate litigation and also thinking of strategy about future choices of targets, be it private or public. And then on the vertical axis here, it's a simple distinction in the social sciences between material and symbolic effects. So material effects are those that one can touch, tangible effects of, for example, a new policy handed down by the board of Shell, or a new policy, a new mitigation target set by a state. Whereas symbolic, these are effects on people's perceptions. And these are equally important. And this is why there are many studies, sociolegal studies, that show that some failed efforts at convincing courts, for example, putting pressure on corporate targets, in the end may have had as consequential, even more consequential impacts on people's perceptions of the issue at hand, for example, corporate responsibility for climate litigation, because of the debate, the lawsuit provoked in the public sphere, in the media, in social movements, and oftentimes some of the most impactful cases in prior waves of litigation had this goal very much in mind, and it was prioritized over the direct effects that one would think were the main goals of the litigation. So this is something that is happening, and I think this is very encouraging in the climate litigation space. So the fact that young activists that some of us have represented in previous cases have continued to be quite engaged in the climate movement and have used those court decisions either for the plaintiffs or for the states or for corporations to then step up their pressure through and from their social movements has been, I think, a particularly encouraging development in climate litigation. And I'll end with a couple of ideas with a different graph about speed, and I'll stop sharing for a moment on speed and scale. As much as human rights is a very powerful institutional infrastructure, and as much as the human rights norms and precedents have been helpful already in speeding up and scaling up climate action. There are some limitations to the status quo in human rights thinking, in human rights law, that I think need to be overcome in order for human rights to be even more useful to the cause of climate action. One has to do with the conception of time in human rights work. Most of the best, the most well-established doctrines in human rights are backward-looking. So human rights is particularly as a system of regulation, as a cultural framework, is particularly good at addressing past violations that can be tracked down to one specific actor. So the classic example, of course, is international criminal law and the way in which the ICC operates. That, of course, is a big mismatch vis-a-vis the nature of climate change, which is global in nature. It is highly decentralized, and solutions need to be forward-looking. And then there is the issue of speed. Human rights have been incredibly helpful, again, to address major violations in many issue areas. But human rights organizations, and I include myself in that field, coming from that field, have not been particularly good at understanding the urgency of the climate crisis. And I'm very encouraged by recent cases like the Neubauer case and the ruling in Germany, because litigants are building into their strategy a very, very intentional and a very explicit conception of the urgency of the problem. So pushing courts to, in turn, put pressure on corporate targets and states to do something now, as the protesters, young protesters in the outside of that room are saying now, is crucial. So it's not just about the what, but about the when. And that particular piece has been missing in many lawsuits that have been carried out based on human rights arguments. And then finally, and this is my last graph here, taken from a blog that I recently published in Open World Rights, if anyone is interested. This is those of you who may be familiar with Kate Raworth's famous book on the donuts, called Donuts Economics, will recognize this graph. Now, this was our best attempt to reproduce the donut, but turn it into a view of how different forms of human rights litigation relate to each other as litigants and advocates climatize human rights tools. So to my mind, one can understand previous waves of human rights litigation as establishing, as protecting the minimum levels of freedom and material well-being that are compatible with a dignified human life. That's human political rights, socioeconomic rights. So this is the inner edge of the donut. But human rights law had not been as competent or as preoccupied with the upper limits, with the ecological ceilings, with the level of air pollution that are compatible with life on Earth, with the levels of ocean acidification, with biodiversity losses, and so on. So one can see the more recent trend towards climate, human rights based climate litigation, and other exciting developments like the proliferation of cases and norms on rights of nature as helping establish that upper boundary, that ceiling of what can be done while keeping the conditions of life in the planet viable. This is why, and this is my last observation, I think we should all be encouraged by the fact that treaty bodies, Special mandates, certainly the great work of the special rapporteurship on human rights and the environment, that they've all tried to grapple with the relationship between, say, socioeconomic rights and climate change through, for example, questions to countries like Australia or even Norway or others about where the funding for social programs is coming from. So it's not enough to ask countries whether or not they're compliant with socioeconomic rights, but the question that's being added in more recent reports and more recent intervention by those three bodies and others is the way in which those programs, social policies are being funded, compatible with the ecological ceilings that we know from science we need to preserve. I'll stay there and happy to continue the conversation in the Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you, Cesar, for giving us, I think you have just prepared us for the plenary session that is going to discuss what the impact of climate change litigation. And he's just pointed out how to assess, one of the things is how to assess the effects of rulings, of decisions coming from court. So our last speaker, last but not least, is Wendy Miles, QC. Wendy is a specialist in, Wendy is a specialist in international arbitration and dispute resolution with 20 essays, focusing on private and public international law. She acts as global coordinating counsel to various major corporates in relation to climate change transition, disclosure, reporting, compliance, and investment. So Wendy will speak to us about, we are moving now from the human rights aspect to international investment agreements. And Wendy will speak to us about climate-related international arbitrations with a primary focus on disputes between states and investors. And her presentation will focus on the way in which international investment agreements can be understood to both advance and hinder climate action. So Wendy, you're welcome.
Thank you so much, Lydia, and it's great to be with you here today. Just take a minute and just pick up that chant and listen to the drum beats. And I don't want you to listen to me and fight that. I want that to be your base. Just keep it, keep listening to it, keep hearing it, because I'm not going to leave human rights, because this is all about human rights. And I am going to talk about commercial investment. I'm going to talk about the money, because that's how we get there on climate mitigation adaptation. But this is what it's about. So don't fight that. It's all that matters. So just keep that beat and acknowledge that as different Indigenous peoples are walking past, the beat's changing. Because there's lots of different beats, there's not one beat. They're all critical and we have to hear them. And we have to bring them into the solution. So the question that's put to me, and I'm sorry for those online if that didn't work for you, but the question that's put to me is, what do you see as some of the biggest evolutions in thinking about how legal norms have developed through other aspects of the legal system and how they're starting to shape commercial practices? And to do that, I want to bring in my system, which is a system of international commercial law or private international law, into the thinking in a different way. Because sometimes we don't think about it like this. And Alex Garton from Fala's there, and she has developed this thinking with me. And we think it works. If it doesn't, let us know. We appreciate feedback. But if you think of your body, remember, keep the speed. If you think of your body as a system, but it's not, is it? It's made up of multiple systems. We all know that from GCSE science. So I want you to imagine three of those systems that run independently but interconnectedly through your human body. I'm going to talk about three of them. There's many, but the three important ones for this discussion the nervous system. If any of you saw Dr. Gunter's Body World exhibition, where he dissected the systems, and you'll remember the nervous system is just these white lines that go through. They don't hold up the body, but they're all the senses. So that's our public international law system. Okay, that's what's happening down at the exhibition center. That's what they're talking about. This Paris rule book or Katowice rule book, whoever you want to give credit to, but it's the rule book that's coming out of that nervous system, and that drives behavior through the whole body. It doesn't move behavior. It just creates the feeling to it. And that's where our human rights laws come from. Not down at the exhibition center, but from that public international law system. Although we're trying. So then there's a muscular system. And that's what they're talking about in the rooms next door, the national legislation, the national litigation, the national court litigation. That's the muscles. That's what moves behavior. Okay, so that's the muscles. But my world is a different system that we don't think about so much. And this Body Worlds exhibition demonstrated it beautifully when the creator, the artist, reconstructed the circulatory system. So he recreated the entire form of the human body out of the blood system. So from the head right down to the tip of your fingers. You don't think about it, but it's there, and it's what keeps the heart beating. And unfortunately for us, it's finance, it's money that keeps the heart beating of our current international order and system. That's what we have. And what's happening down there in the blue zone is that system is mobilizing. It's committing and it's pledging. Those who run that system, the universal owners, the asset managers, the banks, the private financial institutions, representing $130 trillion, have over the last few days said that we're going to flow our blood toward climate mitigation, climate adaptation, and climate resilience. Mostly they're focusing on mitigation, small steps, but mitigation, reducing greenhouse gases to try to reach as close as we can to that 1.5 target by 2050, or staying below it. So what that means in real terms is mobilization of money in investment in the real economy. And there's really three major areas of investment. Remember what the IPCC tells us. There are four systems: energy, land use, infrastructure, industry. They all have to transition to net zero to get us anywhere close to, well, net zero to get us to 1.5, but as close as we can get there. And what there's an enormous amount to talk about are three areas of investment that are required for that. Huge investments, not put this way, but huge investment in the extractive industries. Because the reality of phasing out fossil fuels is phasing in all the lithium, the copper, the rare earth minerals, the cobalt, the coltan, all those natural resources that are required to build the alternative. That's one. Another one is nature-based solutions. And there've been some protests about the carbon markets and about offsets and about, you know, using forests to keep emitting. We have to face up to the reality that we only get even close to net zero if we have some offsetting between now and 2050, possibly beyond. So offsetting is a reality of where we are. But offsetting so often sits at the face of nature-based solutions. So forests, land, ocean. So then the third thing is land use. If you're building new infrastructure, if you're putting a rail system in a country to stop people driving cars, you're going to be taking land, using land for that. If you're building solar farms, they use a huge amount of territory. So all of this investment is piling in to those areas. And they focus very, very heavily on these peoples who are marching on their natural resources and often on their territoriality. So the way it happens now in our system, in that private international law system, is primarily the way the investment happens now, the way the investment, the infrastructure for energy, land use, and our global economy, it happens primarily through public-private partnerships. and they're contracts. They're contracts. And they exist outside the national court system. And they also exist outside, quite often, the national legislative and regulatory system. And the way they do that, to give you an example, is if you had a carbon pricing system, carbon tax in a particular state, there is nothing to stop a foreign direct investor coming into that state and negotiating a public-private partnership with a tax stabilization clause that means that carbon pricing won't apply to them. And unless that law were mandatory, that is the reality of this contractual system. Now, those public-private partnership contracts, agreements, the supply chain, all the contracts in that investment system at the real economy are subject to dispute resolution clauses. And that's when we come to my point, this that I'm supposed to be here to talk about, is most of all, they're subject to international arbitration, so international commercial arbitration. And there's always a lot of talk and a lot of attention about investor state arbitration, investment treaty arbitration, energy charter treaty, but also bilateral, multilateral investment treaties, investment chapters, and free trade agreements. There's only been 1,000 or so cases under investment treaties since they've been around, since the 60s, but only really cases since the end of the 80s. There's only been 72, there's only been 72 awards under the Energy Charter Treaty. Under these public-private partnership agreements, commercial arbitration, there are thousands and thousands of awards every year. So one institution alone, the ICC in Paris, 900 awards a year. And there's hundreds of these institutions. So that is where the capital is being reallocated. That is a system through which it's being reallocated. So if the question is, how is that system? Let me just check my question. What do you see as the evolution and the legal norms developed through that system starting to shape commercial practices? Or has it happened yet? Because you're only talking about reallocating the capital now. It's going to happen from today, and that's going to depend on what we do. And what we need to do is get commercial lawyers who are drafting those agreements, who are structuring those ownership agreements, to hear that drumbeat. And remember, they're public-private partnerships, and we think of public-private partnerships in this context as state and foreign investor. And who are we missing? Hear the drumbeat? We're missing the Indigenous peoples. We're missing the peoples whose territory these investments are taking place in, whose resources are being extracted. That's what's missing. And we need to find a way to bring it in. We can structure these deals around community ownership. It happens in some countries constitutionally, like Canada. It happens in some countries under treaty, like New Zealand, but it doesn't happen universally. And if investors are serious about investing in a different way, about investing in a sustainable way, about investing in a way that preserves the resources for future generations, then perhaps what we should do, what they're asking us to do, and that's listen to the stewards of the land. I didn't time this, but the volume is going up at the perfect moment. Listen, Sweden, but hey, listen to the stewards of the land, because the National Geographic reports that 5% of the world's population is stewarding 80% of the world's ecology and biodiversity, natural resources. So we need to find a way to build them into the commercial contract, into the ownership, into the deal, and find a way that they're able to govern these resources, and we listen and we show a bit of humility, and we follow what they tell us, and we build that into our dispute resolution process. And hopefully when the disputes happen, because disputes always happen, we can come back here and say that norms are changing.
Thank you so much, Andy, for giving us the insight. We will move into the discussion, which will begin with Lisa Van Hala, who will open up the discussion. So before we begin, I'll just small introduction. So Lisa is a full professor of political science at UCL. Prior to joining UCL, she held various positions at the Center for Social Legal Studies in Oxford and at the Center for the Study of Human Rights at LSE. So Lisa, the floor is yours. Then I can give you back the panelists.
Thank you so much, Lydia. And I was tasked with kind of responding on the day. I kind of listened to the presentations and identified some cross-cutting themes and put some questions for our panelists. But really, really what I would like to do is make sure that we're carving out enough time to have a conversation, because there's a lot of people in this room who are, you know, kind of just as well equipped to answer some of these questions. And I know our panelists are all really keen to have those conversations. So there's four things I really wanted to talk about. So the first thing, this kind of, in this room, we are meant to consider the unique role of these international fora. And the way that I think about this as a socio-legal scholar is what is the legal opportunity structure here, right? And Jolene Lynn talks about these different conditions under which you know, you might be more likely to be successful in taking climate change litigation. And so what we've heard from all of these different speakers who are focused on kind of different ways of doing this, from the UNCRC to the International Law on the Sea and the Tribunal and its Tribunal, International Commercial Arbitration, is that there are in some ways a shared set of barriers in all of these kind of international forums. There are issues related to timelines and timeliness and the urgency of the climate crisis and the pace of litigation, and particularly when you have to kind of exhaust domestic remedies. And so that's something that we hear about and that we're hearing kind of creative and interesting and generative solutions to. And that's something I think that we could be talking about. There's of course the technical complexity and issues of causation and bringing in science and the evidence base into these particular fora. And I would also argue the inherent conservatism of some of these fora. And so there's something about pushing on those particular structures, right? What can you do in the litigation, outside of the litigation, to be opening up those legal opportunities? The second thing that I think we've kind of touched on across the different interventions is the relationship between science and law, right? And this is becoming kind of increasingly, I would argue, you know, kind of an easier case to make, right? With the IPCC AR6, you know, we're really starting to move beyond questions of causation. That consensus is there. There are questions about how do we resolve that in these particular fora, which are more amenable to those arguments and why, that I think need to be resolved. But something I think that this community can be thinking about is what is the role for scientists and how can we best bridge the scientific work that's happening and those with that kind of deep scientific knowledge with the goals of human rights lawyers, right? And what's the role of funders, for example, in convening some of those conversations. And I think Wendy really brings that to life when she talks, you know, drawing on IPCC science, is able to kind of identify the particular places to go and have those conversations. And I think that's a beautiful example of linking that kind of what an understanding of the science and bringing in that kind of legal expertise can do and can really advance those conversations. And so I think we should be having those conversations as well. I think the third thing I really wanted to bring in here, and this touches on what Cesar has been talking and writing about climatizing human rights. I would also argue there's a need to think about how do we as a community take a human rights-based approach to climate change litigation in how we diagnose the problems to be addressed and which problems get prioritized and which resources get put where. Whose voices are included in the process and whose aren't, and how are those decisions made? And then thinking about the impacts of climate change, which we'll be looking at in the third plenary. But here I'm really inspired by the work of Jennifer Gordon, who published a piece more than a decade ago called "The Lawyer is Not the Protagonist." And I think there's kind of deep work to be done on how to do community lawyering when we think about our community, which might be a global one, and thinking about neighborly relations in a global sense. Sebastian Jodoin and his co-authors also recently published a piece in Law and Society Review on the right to be cold, looking at the impacts of the Inuit petition kind of, you know, more than 15 years ago, and that work that Ciel was so kind of fundamental in, and going back to those communities and trying to understand what did that case do there? And so how do we think about how we take these cases in a way that is inclusive and respecting of human rights. And then I think the final thing I wanted to point out, I've been in the Blue Zone watching the negotiations as part of my research on the politics and governance of loss and damage. I've been there all week, and you know, really for the first time, this COP, I'm beginning to make sense of my career in a new and different way. On one hand, I've spent a lot of time looking at and studying climate litigation and talking to people who are part of that. And on the other hand, following the geopolitics of loss and damage. And actually, these are all questions, you know, they're all linked to questions about responsibility and liability and compensation and restitution. But I think, you know, there's kind of room for more thinking about how do we link what's going on in those negotiations and the kind of very, very careful drafting of language. So last night, for example, I was watching kind of fairly fierce debates about, do we talk about intergenerational equity or do we talk about protecting present and future generations? Right? And these might feel like kind of quite small things, but those who are involved in those processes know what a difference a comma can make. And so it's thinking about kind of how do we insert language in that particular regime and in that particular space that is fundamentally going to be helpful to this community in engaging with these kind of international fora. And in some ways, that's a translation exercise. So for example, in the UNFCCC, there's a preference, there's a pushing, there's kind of a subtle insertion of language about climate risk. Whereas, you know, when you come at it from a legal perspective, we like to think about climate harm. And so what does that do rhetorically when we talk about it in these two different ways? Risk talks about uncertainty. It kind of raises questions about causation. It all of a sudden puts a number of different barriers in the way to taking action, whereas we understand what harm means. There's a clarity around that. So that's what I've kind of drawn out of the session today. And I really would love to hear a little bit more from all of the panelists on these questions. I think the final question, you know, for me, really, in thinking about kind of international law and what comes out of these four when we take this action, is what happens when it's brought home. Mm-hmm. And Sally Engelmary, the anthropologist, talks about the vernacularization of international human rights law and how it kind of hits home in different ways in different jurisdictions. And Courtney Hilbrich talks about compliance constituencies. So thinking about how do you build that constituency at home, who's going to make sure that those rights begin to translate, that they become real on the ground in particular places and possibly in different ways. And so I think I put those things out there all for consideration, and I'm really looking forward to the discussion and delighted to be here today discussing this with you.
Thank you, Lisa, for the intervention. I don't know if any of the speakers would like to. I know Ingrid has just said that she needs to mute. So
I'm so sorry. Yeah.
Thank you.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Actually, it's
so I don't know if Nikki, Wendy, and Cesar would like to respond to some of the interventions by Lisa before we invite the participants to ask any questions. Would like to start.
Make a comment on science, because you did bring up science, and I think that is really, really important. And I use the science, I think the science is in our, so I'm a common lawyer, so in our adversarial approach to the law and to expert evidence and to witness testimony, we could do great harm to the climate science in particular. And you know, the IPCC has been around since 1988. It was many decades before we actually reached a point where decision makers accepted that what the IPCC was saying ought to be our guiding light at the lowest level. Right, it's the lowest common denominator, really, on the consensus of the climate science. And we also know that the adversarial process, the cross-examination of witnesses and experts, is in absolutes, and it's all about challenging assumptions and challenging statements that are made on the side. I don't think that's all bad. I think sometimes things are overstated, sometimes things are understated, and a good process can get to the middle. But I think there are aspects of that IPCC, the science as reported by the IPCC, that really is sacrosanct and ought to find a way to get to decision makers, whether they're in international courts and regional courts or in arbitration, commercial or non-commercial, investor state or private, that doesn't undermine that or mess with it. And that's something I think we need to work on. I think we need to find a way to persuade the IPCC
to let us have a Making Briefs or spokespeople from the IPCC. And right now the approach is the report says everything, but if you try to explain that report to the court or to an arbitrator, it's hard.
Just to add to what Virginia said, the court is no replacement to peer review mechanisms. Cross-examination does not equal peer review. And so from a law of evidence perspective, one might be able to start objecting to those lines of cross-examination and try and block that particular process from happening, because I'm sure it's a very tempting line of sight for defendants in cases like this.
Judicial review. Of the IPCC report. You just take it. The sky is blue. Scientists in the room, forgive me. The sky is blue. And we just take judicial notice of it. What we like that we take judicial notice of that. Maybe we just take judicial notice of what's in the report. You still need to explain it. Someone still needs to be the user interface. And I don't think lawyers are the best user interface for that.
Okay, so I think Cesar, you can go ahead and then you can respond.
Thank you. I wanted to respond briefly to a couple of ideas that were shared by Elisa and also by Wendy. This panel has been mostly about international legal avenues to put pressure on states, and to a lesser extent, we've talked about corporate actors. But it really, this from the point of view of strategy and the point of view of how actually litigation proceeds, it's a two-level game. Both domestic litigants and those taking cases to the international level, the Committee on the Rights of the Child or European Court of Human Rights or the Advisory Opinion in the Inter-American Court of Human Rights are always simultaneously thinking about the repercussions at the domestic level. So one very positive trait of this body of work is that litigants and social movements that work closely with them have been particularly skillful at creating some synergies between those pressure points at the international level and domestic action. Specifically, many of you who will have read many of these rulings and submissions to national, international judicial and quasi-judicial bodies will have noticed that most cases are framed in terms of the goals of the Paris Agreement plus the recommendations from the IPCC, a case that we've accompanied recently out of CLX against the lack of a serious climate legal framework in Brazil submitted by the Observatory for the Climate just 1 week ago, did just that. They laid out or reminded the Brazilian government about the goals of the Paris Agreement and the commitments made by Brazil in previous years, and inserted the urgency of the latest report from the IPCC. And then the beauty and the magic of many of the lawsuits has been precisely to very explicitly and in a very sophisticated way, vernacularize, to use the term that Sally Mary coined, vernacularize those commitments and bring them down to the local level, where accountability can happen through bottom-up pressure, by going to domestic courts or even regional courts. Now, what I wanted to add to that is that the process really has happened also the other way around. And this is a very encouraging feature of climate litigation. Many of the cases either piggyback on previous waves of litigation and advocacy, mainly, and I am glad that Wendy stressed the importance of indigenous peoples and indigenous people's rights issues, many through the angle of indigenous people's rights advocacy and litigation that date back to the 1990s or 2000s. And one thing that I think is very important to acknowledge is that a lot of the most interesting and potentially most impactful forms of climate litigation doesn't happen under the rubric with the specific label of climate litigation, human rights climate litigation, or climate litigation in general. But in working with indigenous peoples of the Amazon for a number of years now, and now with CLX supporting some cases in Peru and Brazil and Ecuador, one of the responses from an indigenous leader in a workshop that we ran recently was, well, have we not, as indigenous peoples, have been doing indigenous climate litigation and advocacy for 30 years or more now, forever? And that, I think he was absolutely right. So what would normally not count in our databases and or in our discussions, specialized discussions on climate litigation, because it's framed under other under different languages, indigenous people's rights, or even biodiversity loss litigation, which, by the way, I think is going to be an expanding frontier as the CDD process goes, hopefully in the direction of something like the Paris-like framework of action. I think that we will see a lot of fundamental cases for climate mitigation being litigated under the rubric of biodiversity or of action against biodiversity loss. So that that two-way street between the domestic and the international domestic and across different fields of litigation, indigenous rights, biodiversity, and climate, I think is crucial, and it's some of the most exciting and productive areas for new research and litigation.
Thank you for the intervention. I think Nikki also wanted to say something, but there's one question that has also come online for you. So I think you can address both of them together. Then we will finish 5 minutes later because we started 5 minutes late. So we finish at 4:35. Amelia, would you like to read the question?
We have it.
Okay, so this is a question for Nikki from Haro von Assal of Eastern University of Eastern Finland. Given the IEA and production gap reports you mentioned, one could argue that any state providing finance for new fossil fuel production is acting counter to the Paris Agreement's expectation of highest possible ambition. Do you think this provision, perhaps in combination with human rights obligations, could offer a legal basis for litigation against fossil fuel production? And if so, which forum tribunal would be most suitable for this kind of case?
Sure. Yes, Haro.
Take a shot.
So, yeah, I mean, I will say quickly, yes, I do think so. I think that that is an issue that's in part teed up by the case coming before the European Court on the people versus Arctic oil in Norway. That's really about the human rights defensibility or the incompatibility of fossil fuel production with human rights. And I think it will be fantastic to see how that proceeds. I think that's also an issue that's increasingly being brought in domestic courts, including a case pending in the UK right now against the UK's own financing for offshore gas development in Mozambique, and the constitutional and human rights bases and incompatibility with Paris are coming up there. There's far too much on the table to address. There's so many things I'd like to both push back on and raise, but there's no time to address all of them or do them justice. I wanted to just point out a few things that I think are really important as frontiers in human rights law, advocacy, litigation. But so on the issue of science, I think science has always been and will be, in fact, a battleground. As much as I've painted a consensus around impacts, the area that I think is the emerging battleground and will be the terrain of fight and legal fights and policy fights right now is on what actually qualifies as a solution. We can talk about funding for mitigation, but billions of dollars are going into things that are false solutions that are designed to perpetuate the fossil fuel era that don't accelerate the transition. Things like carbon capture, blue hydrogen that are premised on the fossil economy. Like you only equip a facility with carbon capture if it is a fossil fuel burning
facility that is, you know, emitting carbon dioxide. And so by adding on a layer of infrastructure on top of existing fossil fuel infrastructure, you delay the replacement of those technologies. So don't get me started on that. But what I think that I do agree very much so that we need to actually have a better organization and increasing attention as lawyers to how we interpret the IPCC's reports, because that is where the battle is. There, you can read almost anything you want in some IPCC reports. And so it's really important to actually be able to articulate that in a way that's accessible to jurists and accessible to the public. And so it's definitely an area of focus, but it's one that requires even more attention. On the issue of risk, I just wanted to say that I definitely appreciate what Lisa was saying about the difference between risk and harm, but just to put on a glass half full perspective and to think from a legal strategy perspective, one of the challenges has been in proving causation and causal link between a specific harm experience and what's driving it, and apportioning that between multiple tortfeasors, if you will, or wrongdoers under human rights law. But when we talk about risk, there are certain kinds of conduct that do nothing but exacerbate risk. And that is easier to show necessarily than pinpointing the harm that's caused. And so there should be certain things that are taken off the table using a human rights analysis because they add to rather than reduce risk. And the uncertainty under the precautionary principle shouldn't be an impediment to ruling out or preventing adoption of measures that that exacerbate risk. I also wanted to just touch on, and I'll make this my last one, although I have many more things to say, is on the issue of contracting out. And I know that's a bit vague of a reference, but I think a lot of there's lots to say about the issue of ISDS and contracts and their tension. And I would love to have a whole other session on that. I think it's just, we should just be cautious about a response to the ability of commercial actors to contract out of laws of public application. That the response should be that we should just build in what we like to those contracts. I think we have to actually weaken contracts as a regime that is an exception from public law. And maybe I sound like an idealist, but I think that is the aim and that is the objective. It can't be a regime of exceptionalism where you commercially contract out of laws of general application, including human rights law and its universal applications, or that you have to make human rights provisions subordinate to or integrated into commercial contract. We need to subordinate commercial contract to human rights and environmental law. That's the sort of idealist in me speaking. And I fully agree that climatizing human rights and that, you know, lawyers shouldn't be at the center, and that this is, you know, many a conversation are far too white and far too northern and far too privileged, and that's who has access to the courts. And I think it's a challenge for all of us who are doing lawyering and who are seeking to craft normative statements to figure out how we design the remedies we're seeking to rectify the gross inequity of access to justice. Because it, obviously, if you meted out remedy along the lines of who has access to litigation, the people who would get the money as compensation or the injunctive relief are not necessarily those who, in the eyes of the global public, if we can describe that, would be the most deserving of that remedy. And I know that's a very complex concept, and that's not to say there aren't deserving and disproportionately disenfranchised and oppressed communities in the global north. There certainly are. But I think we need to think creatively about how those remedial, how remedies are structured and how those remedial requests are positive so that we can actually rectify that imbalance going forward. Lots more to touch, but thanks all for that.
So, thank you very much to all the speakers, and we do apologize that we are a few minutes late. It was quite an insightful, interesting session, I think, and just judging by the number of questions we got online, and unfortunately, we couldn't take questions in the room, and I do apologize for that, but this just shows how it was quite engaging, and we can continue the conversation of coffee. We have a coffee break of about 25 minutes. So thank you very much to all our panelists and our discussants. And thank you also to our audience for staying with us until this time and for listening.
You didn't join the march
and you decided to come stay with us here. So thank you very much. And thank you as well to our online participants. And we will be joining the auditorium where we were at 5 o'clock. So enjoy your coffee break, continue the conversation, and see you at 5 p.m.